It's Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Stigma from illness keeps sufferers in the dark, where they're ashamed to give voice to their afflictions out of fear and embarrassment. Dr. Anne Hallward, a psychiatrist in Maine, has taken to radio to give voice to those living in the shadows. Tackling tough topics like dementia, mental illness, autism, homosexuality, intimate partner violence, and prison, among many others, Hallward's gentle and respectful interviewing style provides a safe and generous listening environment to her guests and listeners alike. Now in her seventh season at the helm of Safe Space Radio, Hallward has won two consecutive public affairs awards from the Maine Association of Broadcasters, demonstrating the highest esteem from peers in the media. Also on the program today, Gary Schweitzer gives us a review of recent health news, and medical humanist Alice Drager is here with a meditation on using data to guide your own health care. First, this hour's news. It's Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Coming up on the program, we speak to Dr. Anne Hallward, a Maine psychiatrist who's taken to the airwaves to bring solace to those suffering with stigma. But first, with his weekly review of medical media, Gary Schweitzer's on the line from his home office in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Gary.
Good to be back with you.
I want to tackle something with you this week on a topic that you have commented on a lot, which is news releases. Now, one of the things that's confusing in health media is that there are lots of different kinds of studies. There are the so-called gold standard randomized control trials where you'll have two populations. One will take a placebo and one will take a drug, and we compare the drug to the placebo and see if it's better or worse. But a lot of times studies are done what are called observational studies, and these are a little more confusing for patients. The British Medical Journal, BMJ, had some interesting news releases this past summer on its some observational studies that they have published. What was your take on these?
It actually goes back prior to this summer. It's just that it sort of came to a head, and there's a good news ending to it this summer. So, yeah, I have been tracking more than a half dozen times in recent years BMJ news releases on observational studies that simply misstated the quality of the evidence. So your intro was very appropriate. The kinds of trials that you were talking about can give you very strong evidence, the randomized clinical trial, of cause and effect. An observational study is not a true experiment like a randomized clinical trial is. You pretty much just sit back and observe different groups doing different things over time and see if different things happen to them. It's interesting. It can lead to other higher quality types of research, but they cannot, by definition, prove cause and effect. And so, news releases or news stories that use causal language, and I'll give you some in a minute, are inaccurate. And you have to state these things differently, or you're just wrong. So, back in June, start of the summer, there was a BMJ news release. Estimated risk of breast cancer increases as red meat intake increases. Red flag. Increased risk is a statement of causation. This is statistical association, not causation. It's like the rooster crowing every morning does not bring the sun up. Okay? It's not cause and effect. It's just an association. So, that's what the BMJ had in their news release. Does it make a difference? Yeah. I saw stories. Medical News Today is a news organization. Their headline, could red meat consumption increase breast cancer risk? The NBC station here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, said red meat intake could increase breast cancer. The Fox station in Philadelphia, red meat may raise breast cancer risk. All of those are simply inaccurate because they are making causal statements. And it was all kicked off by that news release. Now, I got to tell you, God love the Guardian newspaper in the UK, which quoted an epidemiologist who said six words that we got to remember. Association does not necessarily imply causation. Six words. I wrote about the BMJ and said that's all I'm looking for. That was in June. In July, we had episode 2. You ready for that?
Yeah.
Okay. Another news release. 5 daily portions of fruit and vegetables may be enough to lower risk of death. Lower risk of death. That's a causal statement. This was an observational study following what people ate over time and seeing what happened to them over time. Interesting, somewhat important, certainly not proof of cause and effect. There were 6 times in that news release that they used words that implied causation. So I wrote about it once again. This time, interestingly, the media relations manager for the BMJ Journal wrote back saying, "It's good you keep us on our toes. You're absolutely right. I take full responsibility. We'll look at how we can improve this procedure." Well, this was 6 times in recent years that I've written about it, and that was in July. I'm happy to report in August, yay, they got it right. They publish a lot of journals, and in a news release about one of the journals that they publish, the BMJ wrote in their news release, "This is an observational study, so no definitive conclusions can be drawn about cause and effect. And the researchers admit some potentially important risk factors, such as family history, were not known." Bingo. I can't tell you how good that makes me feel. And again, I think the take-home for your listeners is anytime they see claims that are an exaggeration, that are over the top, hyperbolic, sensational, that they have questions about, they need to let news organizations know. News organizations can go back up the ladder, complain to the people who write the news releases. We're going to continue to look at these things. But I think we all need to rise up and improve the public dialogue. And when we see stuff that is over the top, we need to let the messengers know about it.
Well, it's interesting because these journals, you know, are obviously in a very competitive environment trying to publish the latest and the sort of the most hard-hitting or impactful science. And then they have this sort of these media publicity arms whose job it is, I suspect, to spin the stories and try to make them sound as sexy as possible. And what you're really cautioning them on is they're needing to be honest and forthright in the way they use the word association rather than causation, because it seems like all the time, you know, we hear news stories almost every single day about taking this supplement or eating that food will lower our risk of dying from this cause or that thing or cancer. So your point is very well taken.
Well, and we need to know the number of observational studies is exploding. The news coverage of observational studies is exploding because in a bad journalism economy, the story quota stays high, and yet the resources within the newsroom to cover the news is lower than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So in order to meet that quota, journalists are just taking whatever they find in journals. They can do it right there in the newsroom. They don't have to go out and beat the street to find stories. And so they fall prey to what's in the journal and then certainly what's in the journal's news release. So this whole food chain of how messages get to the public is corrupted, and we lose sight of the people at the end of the food chain, us, the news consumers and healthcare consumers, who are trying to make sense out of this. So this is a big issue, and I'm going to continue to try to plug away at improving the news releases, which might help improve the news stories, and then maybe we can lift all ships.
Gary Schweitzer is the watchdog who gets results, as evidenced here quite clearly. Gary Schweitzer, thank you so much.
You bet, John.
Gary Schweitzer is the founder and publisher of healthnewsreview.org. Our guest today, Dr. Anne Hallward, who's a psychiatrist in Maine, has taken to radio to give voice to those living in the shadows. She tackles tough topics like dementia, mental illness, autism, homosexuality, intimate partner violence. She's gentle and respectful, and her interviewing style provides a safe and generous listening environment to her guests and listeners alike. Her show, called Safe Space Radio, is now in its 7th season. Ann Hallward, welcome to Medical Matters.
I'm so glad to be here, John.
I'm really glad to have you on the program. So you are the host of Safe Space Radio on Community Public Radio in Maine. What gave you the idea to get started doing a show about, well, to provide a safe space?
In my work as a psychiatrist, I felt like I'd had, I think it was maybe like 10 or 11 years of training after college, and I was seeing such a small number of people. You know, I could only fit so many patients into my work week. And I felt like I was seeing shame as this public health emergency. I was seeing that, at least in psychiatry, where there's so much stigma about mental illness, I was feeling like people were not getting help soon enough. And so by the time they finally got into a psychiatrist's office, so much pain and destruction had happened. And I was thinking, how can I reach a larger group of people to help reduce stigma, to help people reach out for help sooner? And I thought, what could public health psychiatry look like? You know, what? It was just brainstorming for a couple years. I was thinking about this. And I was really focused on shame because I felt like that was the thing that is at the heart of therapy. Shame is the thing that really is behind suicide and addiction and so many things. And I thought, shame. And when people feel ashamed, they cover their eyes. They don't want to be seen. And it suddenly occurred to me, radio is the perfect medium to have a public health intervention to reduce shame because you don't have to be seen. The guest isn't seen, and actually the listener usually listens in private. So I had this idea to reduce shame and stigma around mental illness by creating a radio show that is about human stories, about suffering with something that's very stigmatized, very silenced, in a way that allows people to feel less alone and less different.
And you tackle such deep personal issues. I mean, everything from dementia, which we'll talk about, to parents caring for children on the autism spectrum, to dealing with incarceration, to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues, you know, dealing with chronic mental illness. And I get the sense that your program provides indeed a safe space, but a haven for your listeners, your audience, and for, in some ways, for your guests to expound on what it is, their work, and give them a place to show it. What has the reaction been to your program? I mean, you're in your seventh season now.
The reaction has been basically wonderful. You know, I get a lot of email from, actually, initially in my first year, I got most of my email from truckers. And that's when I realized that most people listen to the radio are driving. But then I got a lot of email from parents who felt like their child had this particular issue and wanted me to do a show about that. Mostly the emails are expressions of gratitude that they've suffered with this for years, always in silence, always being afraid to tell someone, and that they felt such relief to hear that they weren't alone in struggling with some feeling that felt awful to them. So that's been thrilling to me, just thrilling.
Do you consider yourself a general psychiatrist in that you care for people who sort of have all of these problems along the spectrum of things you've covered in radio?
Well, I'm an adult general psychiatrist. I don't work with anyone younger than 16. I do mostly therapy, although I also prescribe medicines if that's necessary. I'm trying to think, have I worked with every... So, you know, we did that series on LGBT, lesbian, gay, transgender, and questioning teenagers. And that, in my own mind, was fundamentally about suicide prevention because we know that LGBTQ teens are the highest risk for suicide and that if people can feel like there's hope and there's other people who get it and there's ways to talk about it, I felt like that, you know, that right there can make it safer for people. I haven't worked clinically with too many people with a felony record, although we did a whole series on the stigma of that. Not sure if I would say clinically I have done so much in my practice with that population. But parents with kids with autism, you know, as you know, John, it's increasingly common, so I'm seeing more and more of that. And dementia is not only in my clinical work, but in my own family, so.
That was something that was so powerful listening because you interviewed your own mother about caring for your father.
I did. That felt like a real taboo because, of course, the old school of psychiatry is that the psychiatrist is not supposed to disclose. And I was concerned about that being too much information. But in the end, I felt like it was important to speak about some of the real challenges of loving someone who has dementia and name some of the very difficult sort of silenced aspects of that experience. So it felt like it was finally worth doing.
One of the things that your series on dementia revealed was the tremendous burden placed on caregivers of patients that have dementia. If it's okay, I'm going to play a clip here from one of your programs where a caregiver, maybe you could set this up for us, where a caregiver talks about the burden of caring for a loved one with dementia?
Well, actually, as you'll hear in the clip, this is actually the mother who has dementia not wanting to be a burden to her daughter. And it's about how the daughter really understood that. But this is, so the person I interviewed, Liz Haview, is a woman who had gone through something called the Savvy Caregiver class, which is a class offered through an agency on aging here in Southern Maine. And she was very courageous in being willing to talk about actually her own wishes that her mother would die and how hard it was to name that, how awful that felt. And so I interviewed her because I know that so many caregivers feel that way and feel awful about even putting it into words. And so all these people are feeling it and kind of hiding it and feeling awful about it and wanting her voice to kind of help other people feel less bad about their own feelings. So that's the setup. This is Liz Haview, who invited her mother with dementia into her home to live with her.
One time I went into her bathroom, this is before I knew we were having real issues, or that I needed to pay attention to the bathroom. I went in and there was no toilet paper on the roll, and there was a paper towel. And I said, Ma, you're out of toilet paper. You know, what are you doing? She goes, well, I didn't want to bother you. That's a very small piece, but my mother never, ever wanted to be a burden to us. If she really, really knew how stressful and how hard this is, she would be one of those people that would say, okay, boom, you know, take a gun or, you know, she would want to die. So in many ways, for me to say that I wish she would, I know that she would. Because she's not the person she was. And so for me to say that, I wish more people could say it. Because they're not, you know, if they're thinking it, they're not alone when they think it. And it's okay to say it out loud. It's healing, it's helpful, and it takes some of that ick that's inside you and brings it out, because then you know, it's real.
Anne Hallward, how did you come across this story?
There was an interview with her in the newspaper. I think it was a profile about the Southern Maine Agency on Aging and about their Savvy Caregiver class. And she was sort of like the poster child for the class. So I read her story and I thought, oh, I absolutely want to interview her. Because it's so courageous to talk like that.
It's quite a story. I'm so overpowered by the sharing that the people that you interview offer you each week on the program.
Well, I feel like, you know, when I started doing this, I'd listen to either TV talk shows or radio talk shows, and I was always so frustrated at the relative lack of depth, like the lack of intimacy of the conversation. It felt like the host often wasn't listening or not really taking it deeper. And so I thought, well, my training as a therapist, I want to use that to really create a safe space for someone to speak from their heart. And so when I first started, I thought that was all there was to it. That I just had to create a safe enough space and my guest would tell this incredibly beautiful, heartfelt story and it would just be wonderful radio. And then sort of since doing it, I've learned that there's a little more to it in the sense that the listener wants to know a few more things, like who, what, where, why, you know, like you need to ground the story. So I had to learn a lot more about journalism, broadcast journalism. But creating a safe space, creating a relationship with my guests so that they can share something very risky, very heartfelt, that is the heart of what I do. That is, I think, what defines what I'm trying to do anyway.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Anne Hallward, who's a psychiatrist in Portland, Maine. She's the host of the program called Safe Space Radio that's broadcast on WMPG Community Public Radio in Southern Maine. She's hosted that show since 2008. She's just started her 7th season. And we were talking about dementia as a challenge for caregivers. in fact, talking about some of the very complicated emotions that caregivers have in dealing with the burden of dementia. And Anne, I wanted to play another clip for you where you interviewed someone who talked about the ambiguity in providing care for someone with dementia. Could you set that up for us?
Yeah, so her name is Pauline Boss, and she'd written a book about ambiguous loss in which she explains that there's a real challenge in grieving someone who's sort of both here and not here at the same time. That's what dementia is so much like. The person seems here, but they also seem not here, and it's so confusing.
Okay, Anne Hallward's interview with Pauline Boss on Safe Space Radio.
This type of ambiguous loss, and that is where the person is present in the home or nearby, you know where they are in body, but in their mind, their memory is fading, their cognitive abilities might be fading, and they may not even know you anymore. It becomes a complicated loss and therefore a complicated grief, and one that could go on for years. The ambiguity causes ambivalence, and the ambivalence manifests itself in mixed emotions. For example, you love this person, but there are moments when you hate them, and many caregivers, for example, who have been at it for many, many years, will say in confidence, "I wish it were over." And that creates guilt, because what they're really saying is, I wish my loved one would die, so it would be a clear-cut loss instead of this confusion I'm working with, this ambiguity. And when people have thoughts like that, and we all have, I think they're very normal. It's normal to have the thought, but not to act on it, by the way. And so guilt follows that kind of the negative side of ambivalence. And we need to have caregivers and family members talk with other people so that they don't feel that they need to carry the guilt.
Yes. Yeah, it's such a terrible feeling for the caregiver to have these moments when you realize that you wish for their death.
And here is what I say to people like that, that having that feeling is quite normal. In fact, you may, underlying it all, may be some compassion for the person with the illness, that you wish their suffering were over. The thing we cannot do is act on it, because that leads to abuse and violence. We have to not act on our ambivalence. We have to be able to carry the idea that our loved one is all right. In fact, frequently with dementia, they are not suffering as much as the caregiver is. And that may be why caregivers die at a rate 63% higher than their same age group.
So, Anne Hallward, caregivers die at a higher rate than the comparable age group?
There is a study that suggests that. The study that I'm more familiar with is about the rate of depression among caregivers, which is very high. Caring for a loved one with dementia in your own home is an overwhelming task, because you're not only grieving the loss of your former partner and companion or your parent, but you're also suddenly taking care of a dependent who may need to be watched 24/7, and who, you know, unlike looking after a child where you're caring for a dependent, but there's so much hope about the future and the growth of where they're, what they're learning, this is the kind of dependency where it's a progressive illness where there's going to be more and more loss. So it's so hard, that kind of double punch of the loss and all the incredible needs that you need to take care of. So painful for people. And as a result, and also it's very isolating, John. So caregivers, you know, it's very hard to get out because they can't leave the person alone. It's much harder to find a babysitter for your mother with dementia than it is for your child. So caregivers end up being quite isolated. And this is just a very, very challenging role.
She mentioned in the clip, she gave voice to the conflicting emotions of, I guess, the anger and the shame. And you mentioned how your program is really a place to give voice to shame. But I wonder, is guilt the other side of the coin that is shame?
Great question. So the distinction that I make between guilt and shame is that guilt is, I feel bad about a very specific thing that I did. So as I feel bad about this behavior. Shame is a much more global sense about I am unlovable. If you really knew who I was, if you knew this thing about me, you wouldn't want to be close to me anymore. So it's about the fear of the sort of this feeling of badness and unlovability, which is far more damaging in the long run. It makes people hide and isolate. And ultimately, you know, I think is at the root of much addiction and much suicide.
So your own father suffered with dementia. And your mother was his caregiver. As you alluded to earlier, you broke the taboo, at least in the psychiatry world, of sharing personally by going on radio and talking about your own family, and probably the other taboo of interviewing your parent in sort of a almost a medical sense, but in a very clinical sense. How did that affect you, doing that interview?
It affected me a lot ahead of time, just anticipating and wrestling with myself about whether it was the right thing to do. If some of my patients heard it, would it get in their way? Would it be a distraction from what they needed me for their own life? But doing it, you know, was wonderful. I was so proud of my mother. She did such a beautiful job. She was so courageously honest. And she was just eloquent. It was lovely in terms of my relationship with her to feel, I felt so close to share this project together. And ultimately, I was thrilled about it. I ended up giving a talk about my dad as well to the Maine Association of Psychiatrists. And in that talk, it was on end-of-life care with dementia. And I'd made a decision. It's sort of like the analogy I make is coming out of the closet, sort of daring to say this thing that I kind of attempted to hide. And so I talked about visiting my dad and how every time I'd visit him, I'd think, oh God, if I was him, would I want to be alive anymore? You know, I was trying to sense, it felt like he'd outlived his life. You know, he didn't recognize any of us for about 5 years. He was mute for about 2.5, 3 years. So he was living, sort of felt like he was trapped in this very vacant experience of life. And I was just anguishing to see him like that. And so I would often lie in bed at night and think about, you know, how could I help him die? Which felt awful. You know, I'm a doctor. I'm supposed to be helping people live full lives. And it just felt awful to be even thinking that way. So I'm telling this story to this group of psychiatrists, about 100 psychiatrists in this room. And I confess to them that I would lie in bed at night and fantasize about breaking into the Maine Medical Center lab and getting some pneumococcus, some bacteria, and snorting them up my father's nose to help him get pneumonia, to help him die.
The old man's friend.
Exactly. Pneumonia is not a bad way to go. So I confessed this to this group of doctors, the eyebrows that went off around the room. And I thought, oh God, what have I done? I promised maybe that was too much information. And I drove home, and halfway home, I had to pull over, and I just wept. Just wept because I realized that for years I had grieved my father. He had dementia for 16 years, so I had been just grieving his loss over years and years and years, and I had pretty much done that grief. But I had never actually grieved how awful it was to wish him dead, how awful it was as a daughter who loved him so much to wish for his death. It just felt, oh, you know, really desperate inside me. And so it was this actually wonderful grief. I mean, pulling over the side of the road and crying is not really that fun, but it was such a relief and a release to mourn that part of it, which I had not ever done before. And then here's the thing that sort of is so in keeping with what I believe about Safe Space Radio, which is that I also felt ashamed, like, oh God, maybe those people didn't think I loved my father. Maybe they thought I was a horrible person, you know? And then I got home and I started getting all these emails from people thanking me for telling it and how their parent had also had dementia or their spouse and how they'd felt the same and how awful they'd felt. And then about 3 months later, I got another letter from a colleague saying her mother had just died with dementia and how she had felt kind of empowered to withhold antibiotics when her mom got pneumonia, to really let her go, to take that as sort of her ticket out. And thanking me for that talk as a way to kind of give her permission to do that. And I felt so happy. Like, this is what I believe, that if we dare to speak about these shameful things that we feel horrible about, it kind of opens a door for other people to begin to think, you know, dare to acknowledge it or dare to feel like maybe they could do something like that too. So that was just this very beautiful experience for me of the power of speaking these awful truths and the gift that it can maybe be for someone else.
Were there things in the interview with your mother that you learned that you hadn't previously known?
I don't think so. We talked a lot throughout his long illness. I think maybe the one thing is my mother was not his sole caregiver. She, you know, we were lucky enough to be able to afford some in-home caregivers. And so she was able to get out and to still have a life, which was, I think, hugely important for her and for all of us. But she told me something I hadn't understood before, which was that when she tried to be his caregiver, when she tried to bathe him, he had refused her. He'd been furious with her. He had rejected her as her caregiver, and she'd felt awful about that. And then when the first person she'd hired in who'd come in and helped him bathe, he was completely cooperative and even grateful. And it made my mother realize, like, oh, he doesn't really want me in that role, probably because he didn't want to be a burden, same thing. And it helped me appreciate her more, because there were times when I felt critical of her, like, Mom, why aren't you more involved in being his caregiver? Poor Mom, I feel sad to admit that. She knows that. But I think that was the new thing, of realizing that he hadn't wanted it either. He hadn't wanted her to be kind of stuck in that role in relation to him. That helped me in some ways appreciate her more.
You're listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is psychiatrist Anne Hallward, and we've turned the tables. She's the host of Safe Space Radio on WMPG Community Public Radio in Portland, Maine, for all of Southern Maine, a show she's hosted since 2008. She's just started her seventh season as host of Safe Space Radio, and I'm delighted to have her here in the guest chair today, getting interviewed, talking about her show. And I wanted to read a paragraph from your show's mission statement, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Safe Space is a show about subjects that are hard to talk about, a respectful forum for courageous conversations about difficult subjects in order to reduce stigma, provide education, offer hope and access to resources. It is a space for the in-depth discussion of matters that touch hearts and yet feel risky to share, subjects that deserve but rarely get thoughtful consideration. And when I look over the list of your programs and the way you've tagged them along with some keywords, I mean, there are some very, we might call, heavy-duty topics there. One of the other topics that you have done a number of shows on, and we alluded to that earlier also, was on awareness of homosexual feelings for people, you know, young people, particularly lesbian, bisexual, gay, transgender. I have a clip here from one of your programs from a high school teacher who talks about an experience of a student who was in her high school class who came back to talk to her years later. Can you set up this clip for us?
Yeah, so this is an interview with Betsy Parsons, who now actually has been very active in something called GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, that helps support gay, straight, trans alliances in high schools. And she supports these groups for kids all around the state that have been shown now to actually prevent suicide, prevent depression, not only for LGBTQ teens, but also for straight teens, especially straight boys who often get bullied in homophobic ways, like being called a wuss or, you know, all manner of hate language I don't actually feel like repeating, that if you have a GSTA in a school, it creates a safer climate for everyone in that school. So anyway, I could go on and on, but Betsy Parsons was a former high school teacher, and this is a story about her decision to come out as a teacher, which at that time was very risky.
At about that same time, a student came back to see me who had been a ninth grader in my in an honors class at Portland High years before. She had now graduated from college and had come back to see an old teacher. And, you know, it's one of the joys of the profession, right?
Right.
You know, you get to see them grown up and see what they've made of themselves and where they're going with their lives. So she came back to visit and talked to me about the wonderful relationship she was in with a woman partner. And I was so happy for her. And I felt free at that point, since we were both grown-ups, you know, I felt free to disclose this part of my life to her and the happiness I had in my relationship. At that point, she really stunned me by sharing what the reality of ninth grade had been like for her. And when she was in my class, I frankly worried about her less than anybody else in the class. Her life looked perfect to me. I had no idea of the loneliness that she was experiencing, the alienation, the fear. She knew she was lesbian. She felt she could tell no one. And she really was feeling quite hopeless about her future. She was an extraordinarily gifted student who could see no way that she was going to be able to have her life. And she couldn't see how she could do work commensurate with her skills and gifts, and she didn't know how she was going to hang on to her family or build a family of her own or any of those things. So I was just really shocked to hear how desperate that year had been and how close she had come to not being here. And at one point I asked her, I was in tears, and I asked her, what could I have done? What could I have done as your ninth grade teacher that would have made that year and maybe high school in general more bearable for you? And she was kind enough to make a nice list of things that I had done. And I actually didn't remember doing them, but they sounded like me, you know? Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, well, maybe I did actually do some of those things.
Right.
But then she looked me right in the eye and said, but Betsy, you know what you could have done that really would have made the difference for me? She said, you know, you were a wonderful teacher. I respected you. My parents respected you. She said, if I could have known that you and I were alike in this way, I would have had so much more hope for my life. She said, you could have been out. You could have been out.
That's a powerful clip. How did you react to that story?
I love that story. It just felt such a powerful example to me of how someone daring to be real is not only an act of courage, we know that, but it's an act of generosity. Because when one person has the courage to come out and to talk about something quite vulnerable, it really does make it safer for other people to do that. And that's what that student was saying to her. You know, if you had been out, my parents respected you, you know, it would have helped people. It helped me feel like I could have a good life, you know. And so I feel like it is a public health intervention, interestingly enough, to come out of the closet in whatever way that is, to talk about mental illness, talk about having a child with autism, to talk about how hard it is to be a caregiver, because other people in that same situation will feel so much relief. Like, oh, I just love this clip. It kind of captured really what I believe in.
Do you have any sense of, in your area in Southern Maine, what impact this has had, or whether it's the radio program itself or just sort of the changes in social trends for acceptance of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered individuals?
Yes, well, we're thrilled, you know, because Maine, I think by about 20 minutes on an election year, you know, was the first state in the country to pass marriage equality by actual popular vote. You know, many states had done it through the justices, you know, of the state or the legislature doing it, but actually by having a popular vote, we were the first. I think we beat Maryland by about 20 minutes, something like that. But so one thing that concretely came out of a series we did about transgender youth maybe 4 years ago is that in the last interview in the series, my guest said to me, you know, in order for someone to have sexual reassignment surgery, they need to have been assessed by two doctoral level clinicians who say that, yes, this is really right. This person is ready. This is, you know, I concur. And there's only one doctoral level person in Maine. Would you be willing to be trained to be that second person? So they asked me this in a live radio show on the air. And I was sort of like, I don't know. You know, that's not really my area of specialization. I'm not sure. But I sort of collected myself and said, well, I'll do you one better. I will put on a training. So we created a training that 12 psychiatrists came to spend an afternoon learning all about these issues. And none of us had any training in this in our residencies. And so we got 12 people in Maine, doctoral level clinicians, who knew at least a little bit more. I don't think you can really grasp it all in an afternoon. But trying to create a more sort of trans-friendly culture, even among mental health professionals, so that trans individuals could have someone they could go talk to who would feel respectful and safe. So that's one small thing, very concretely, that came out of the radio show.
Great leadership skill, though. And you were being kind of asked on the spot to make a very challenging decision and to then sort of use the jujitsu effect of saying, well, let's broaden this And now, you know, essentially have 12 times the effect of getting 12 different clinicians who are able to now sort of help determine in these cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, even that recommendation has evolved over time. But yeah, so now, I mean, I think the consciousness about being trans is still, you know, relative to being lesbian or gay is still very early. You know, a trans person is still the most risk of violent assault in our culture of anyone. Race, class, whatever, if you are a trans individual, your vulnerability to violent assault is extremely high. So this is, again, this is a public health, you know, safety issue here that we're talking about, is trying to create a world that is safer for people, you know, from being assaulted. So yeah, I was thrilled about that. I was sweating in the moment. It made me very nervous. But I really feel thrilled. I feel thrilled about what happened.
And I want to ask a little bit, you're obviously a very gifted interviewer and have devoted your career to being a generous listener. But you mentioned that in your quest to, in a sense, broaden the impact and destigmatize a lot of mental illness, or I guess physical illnesses as well, you had to really learn some of the art of radio broadcasting. And I wonder how that's impacted your practice, for one thing.
That's a great question. I always think of it in the other direction, John, about how my practice influences my radio work. Well, of course, in this concrete way, you know, I feel like I know more about, it's educated me. So I think, you know, after medical training, an ongoing issue for all doctors is, how do you stay current? How do you keep learning? There's all these conferences about that. I'd been teaching at Harvard Medical School. So I've been surrounded by all these, you know, really exciting intellectual colleagues, and I moved to Maine, and I wasn't teaching actively among students all the time. I do supervise residents in my office, but I wanted to keep my mind alive. I wanted to keep learning, and this radio show has helped me learn so much about things that I didn't learn in my own training. So I hope it's made me a much better clinician, much better informed. It's given me a little bit of a window into the real human experience of living with certain struggles that I didn't have that window before.
Have there been communities that have formed up around Safe Space Radio, like Facebook groups or social media share, you know, where people who are impacted by your broadcasts are able to get together or share?
I love that idea, John. I want to do that. I mean, what we do, so at the end of every interview, I always offer resources. So that not only do sort of people learn about it, but then there's something, a concrete next step they can take. So I often steer people to support groups or different Facebook social groups or chat rooms, you know, things that people, ways that people can find each other. So I steer people sort of out. Safe Space Radio itself, we do have a website, which is safespaceradio.com, and people can comment there. And there is a Facebook page for it as well. But, the truth is, because I'm, you know, in full-time practice and do this radio show as a volunteer in my off hours, I just haven't had the time to really invest in the social media part of it. And I would love to be able to do that. We've applied for all kinds of grants that I hope will let us expand in that way.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you've enjoyed a lot of success, and you're already, I mean, 7 seasons is quite an accomplishment. You're in your 7th. Where do you see the show going? Where would you like it to go if you were able to procure those grants?
I have 2 different directions I'm hoping to go in. One is, I would love to get on MPBN, which is the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. There are 7 NPR stations in Maine, and I would love for them to carry this show. And maybe even take it regionally or larger. That would be one. And the second is to try to have more of a community outreach component to it, to have the show be used for something. So we are in the process of trying to kind of package these half-hour interviews into little 3 to 4 minute highlights that can be put into a curriculum. So there's 2 different courses. There's 2 different universities in Southern Maine that are now teaching from the show in their curriculum, whether that's in social work or women and gender studies, sociology, social work training. So it's beginning to be used as an educational tool. We want to incorporate it into the clinical training of psychiatrists, social workers, psychologists, licensed mental health clinical counselors. You know, I'd love for it to be used as a training tool, but I also want to bring it out into the community. So have it be used in the prison. We talked a lot about stigma of having a record. You know, how do you live with that? How do you get a job and, you know, if you have a record, or if you're a parent with someone with autism, have the show be brought out into the preschools and maybe be used as a part of a discussion or a facilitated discussion among parents to bring out some of the issues that are harder to speak about. So I have all kinds of ideas about how to use the show to help people talk to each other and hear each other in a way that makes people feel less isolated and more understanding of people who are different from them. My vision is also that it's not just about reducing stigma because, you know, that helps people get help easier or that helps people suffer less or be more, you know, less isolated. My real hope is that it does contribute to cultural change and even political change. So, you know, as the culture around equality in marriage has changed, you know, the laws start changing. And I think we did a long series on domestic violence, and the governor of Maine, Paul LePage, he suffered significant domestic violence in his childhood, and he was a guest on my show talking about his experience with domestic violence and the work that he was doing legislatively to try to, you know, very small steps, like have someone who's battered, if the police get called in the middle of the night, they would often get released back to the home 3 hours later. So he was trying to make it so that that was not going to happen anymore. And his courage in coming out with his own story, I think, contributes to actually not only changing the culture, but changing the laws. So I really think that shame has a very powerful relationship to power, that when we feel ashamed, we're silent and we're isolated, and so we can't work together to change things. And if you think about all the major social movements, they're finally about people shedding shame. So if you think about civil rights movement, about not sitting in the back of the bus anymore like a second-class citizen. If you think about women's rights, you know, it's about daring to be, you know, have your voice and be loud and have ambition and not be apologetic. If you think about gay rights, it's about shedding shame. So I have this really, I feel very excited about the way that shame is sort of at the intersection between psychological healing, but also social change. And at the risk of sounding, you know, overly ambitious, I do have that dream that this show will contribute to not only to psychological change, but also social change.
Anne Hallward is a psychiatrist in Portland, Maine. She's the host of Safe Space Radio, now in its 7th season. You can learn more about it at safespaceradio.com. Big data is all the rage in healthcare. Every day we have more information than ever before. Sorting through it can be quite a challenge. Our newest commentator, Alice Drager, offers us this reflection on using big data to inform her personal healthcare.
When I decided to give birth without painkillers, I didn't do it because I'm a compost-loving earth mother. I did it because I'm a modern data geek. I had looked at the medical literature with my husband. He's a doctor in internal medicine. And we had learned that the use of painkillers causes a small increase in risk for mothers and babies. So I decided against painkillers to keep myself and my baby a little bit safer. Because my husband's also a data geek, and because we're both trained as researchers to look stuff up, we went with the data on everything. Mostly that meant opting out of various medical technologies. So many had been shown in clinical studies to increase risk rather than decrease risk in a healthy pregnancy like mine. We even skipped prenatal sonograms. That's because when I was pregnant in the year 2000, good studies showed that prenatal sonograms didn't improve outcomes for mothers or babies in pregnancies like mine, what doctors call uneventful pregnancies. Fetal hiccups and a little sciatica for the mother don't count as eventful in obstetrics. Once I was in labor, the baby's heart rate was checked only every 5 minutes or so. Studies show checking it more frequently increases risk of harm. That's because checking it too often leads doctors to unnecessarily intervene in labor. There was also no episiotomy to try to quote-unquote help my labor. What did seem to help my labor, as the study showed would, was getting up and walking around. It was easy to do this because I wasn't unnecessarily hooked up to an IV pole. I realized later that I probably looked in labor a lot like my great-grandmothers did, walking around, talking and laughing, and groaning, smiling, and crying. For my pregnancy and birth, we had a certified nurse midwife. That's not because studies showed they were safer than doctors, the data's here and there, but because we couldn't find an obstetrician who would follow science as well as our midwife did. We also employed a doula, a professional labor support person. Doulas have been shown in studies around the world to reduce risk to mothers and babies. One obstetrician has said that given how effective and how safe doulas are, if they were a drug, it would probably be illegal not to give one at every birth. What makes me sad about birth in America is not how much money is wasted on it, or how often women and babies end up harmed by interventions that are well-intended but poorly evidenced. What makes me sad is how it's an opportunity lost to teach people about the difference between technology and science. We often assume that more technology will leave us safer. But science, looking at things scientifically through careful data collection, often shows that medical technology can increase rather than decrease risk. Just imagine an America where every baby was born supported by science rather than technology.
Alice Drager is a professor of clinical medical humanities at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. She lives in East Lansing, Michigan. Medical Matters is produced at Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. You can contact the show directly by emailing me at schumann.john@gmail.com. That's schumann.john@gmail.com. Medical Matters is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Music for the show is created by Scott Griffith. Our theme music is by Europa 51. You've been listening to Medical Matters, the show about healthcare and the human condition. I'm John Schumann.
University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.